Good evening. I'm Renee Barrio, Chief Curator here at the McNay. It's my pleasure and honor to welcome you to this evening's distinguished lecture by Isabel DeVoe. Isabel is the Acquavella Curator of Modern and Contemporary Drawings at the Morgan Library Museum in New York. Thank you for joining us this evening. And before we continue, I just want to remind you to turn off your cell phones so we don't have any interruptions during the presentation. Tonight's lecture is presented in conjunction with our exhibition, Real Surreal, drawn from the collection of the Whitney Museum of American Art. Real Surreal includes paintings, drawings, prints, and photographs that span several decades of the 20th century, and many of the works in the exhibition invite viewers to think about the point at which realism ends and surrealism begins. Real Surreal is presented in conjunction with The Human Face and Form, which is drawn from the collection of the McNay and features works of modern and contemporary sculpture. If you haven't seen our two exceptional exhibitions, Real Surreal remains on view through May 19th, about 2 more months. And we've extended The Human Face and Form through October 6th. You have the whole summer to enjoy that exhibition. And certainly, if you have seen these, you know that both exhibitions require return visits. Tonight's lecture is a program of the Lewis A. and Francis B. Wagner Lecture Series, and we appreciate that support. And now about our speaker for tonight. Isabel DeVoe holds a PhD in art history from the Institute of Fine Arts at NYU. Before joining the curatorial staff of the Morgan Library Museum, she was chief curator at the National Academy Museum in New York and associate curator at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. In 2005, she organized Surrealism USA, a major survey of surrealism in the United States. Other recent exhibitions include Roy Lichtenstein, The Black and White Drawings, 1961 to 1968, and Dan Flavin, Drawing. She has published extensively on 20th century American art, including essays on Joseph Albers, Philip Guston, Mark Rothko, and Yves Tanguy. Currently, she's co-organizing the exhibition Subliming Vessel, The Drawings of Matthew Barney, opening at the Morgan this May. And on view right now at the Morgan is Drawing Surrealism, which she co-organized. This evening's presentation is titled Surrealism and the American Imagination. Please join me in welcoming Isabel DeVoe to San Antonio and to the McNay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction, and I would also to congratulate the staff that has been involved in the installation of the exhibition Real Surreal, which I think looks just wonderful. And this is a particularly interesting exhibition for the way it forces us to reconsider the traditional categories in art history. It shows how the separations between movements can be uncertain and shifting. It also demonstrates how international movements, in this case surrealism, develop differently in different countries due to local tradition and culture. And thus, in the United States, the realist tradition, which was particularly important throughout the art history of the country, affected the way surrealism was perceived both by the public and by artists. So the purpose of this lecture is to examine how surrealism, a movement that began in France in the mid-1920s and became known in America in the late 20s and early 30s, took a different direction in this country. What did American artists retain from it, and what they integrated in their practice, what did they change, what did they reject, and how did it influence and transform their art? Or in brief, how does American surrealism differ from European surrealism? To set the stage, I will start with a brief reminder of what surrealism is and how it became known in the United States. Surrealism was officially launched in Paris in 1924 with the publication of the first manifesto of surrealism written by the poet André Breton. It was defined from the start as an attempt to free the creative unconscious through automatism, a method that consists in writing or drawing without control of reason, that is, trying to disregard aesthetic or moral concerns. Surrealism rejected rationality and logic to embrace the marvelous, the extraordinary, especially as it manifests itself in everyday life in the form of the unexpected, in chance encounters, in the accident, etc. Under the influence of Freud, the Surrealists explored the world of dream as a source of imagery. In the visual arts, there was not one specific Surrealist style, but a number of characteristics that were associated with it. And I'll show some of these. So first would be the use of chance, which was experimented in drawing techniques. On the left is André, on your left is André Masson, Délire Végétal, a typical automatic drawing, which means that the artist tries to start the drawing by sort of doodling or making quick drawing. The speed is important to avoid the control of reason, and jot down something on the sheet, and then in a second phase, he looks at it was done and continues, finishes some of the forms, which is why this becomes this, you see leaves, and so you have this sense of, that's how he gave it the title of Vegetal Delirium. On the right is another type of use of chance with Max Ernst, that's the frottage, which is just the word for rubbing, in fact. And even though you can see that he drew specifically the contour of the eye, the surface is obtained by rubbing the sheet, putting a hard texture under the sheet of paper and then rubbing the pencil and obtaining all those unexpected patterns. Some of those techniques that were experimented in drawings, then they applied to painting. So here are two examples by the same artist, Masson, Battle of Fishes, where it's a sand painting, so he would randomly apply the glue to get those unexpected patterns. He would apply the glue and then put sand on the canvas, which is flat on the floor, then tilt the canvas, and the sand remains only where the glue was. And the glue was applied just like an automatic drawing. So that's how he gets those patterns. And then decides this looks like a maritime landscape, so he added fishes, etc. And in the case of the Ernst, it's also equivalent of the frottage. With painting, it's called grattage because it's from a scrape. Gratter, which means to scrape, so he scrapes the paint, but it's basically the same method. And as you see here, it's to evoke the Porte Saint-Denis is a big architectural building in Paris, and if you see at night, you might have, you're not sure what you are seeing, and this it's the whole idea of the unexpected, the surprising, that is so central for surrealism. Another typical surrealist device is the odd juxtapositions, which you find in a collage, for instance, and you have on the left a collage by Max Ernst. The collage is especially with familiar objects that suddenly lose their familiarity because of the context in which they appear. So, for instance, in this one, where you are not quite sure why this woman has two sets of legs, etc. And on the right is an exquisite corpse, which was kind of drawings that they were doing in collaboration using a folded sheet of paper, and each one does part of the drawing without seeing what the other has done. And so you get those sort of grotesque figures or, again, surprising effects. Now, not all the surrealists embraced the idea of chance. They found that these methods were too passive, and they chose instead to evoke dreams and fantasies in a more deliberate style. This is the case of Miro, who was mostly inspired by poetry, creating compositions of signs and symbols that were assembled through a process of free associations, as in this Carnival of Harlequin. And he creates thus a world that is neither abstract nor figurative, where everyone can in fact follow his own thread of interpretation. And it was especially the case of Dali and Magritte, you find two examples here, who paint dreams and irrational worlds in a technique that is reminiscent of the old masters. because of the naturalistic depiction, one is uncertain where the border is between the real and the unreal, between dream and reality. Now, most of the works I have shown so far were done in Paris in the 1920s. So when and how did surrealism come to the U.S.? American artists became aware of surrealism in the late 20s through some works that were works by European artists that were included in group shows, and also through reproductions in avant-garde publications. But it was primarily two exhibitions in the early 1930s that introduced the movement to the United States. And on the left is the sort of brochure that accompanied an exhibition done at the Wordsworth Athenaeum in Hartford, Connecticut, if it may sound like an unlikely place for a major large surrealist exhibition. It was because the director, Chick Austin, was just a devotee of avant-garde. And as you can see, they hadn't quite decided on the name to adopt in English. Obviously, you know, French name was Surrealism. And so Chick Austin thought it should be translated, which would be Super Realism. And that's how it's referred to initially. But a few months later, there was another exhibition in New York, this time organized by Julian Levy, and Julian Levy decided the word cannot be translated, and he called his exhibition Surrealism. That's an announcement designed by Joseph Cornell for the exhibition, and from then on, the word Surrealism will just be used with the difference, which doesn't appear here, that the E at the end will be dropped because it's too French, I suppose, but... And finally, in 1936, Alfred Barr, who was the director of the Museum of Modern Art, organized a large exhibition called Fantastic Art, Dada and Surrealism, which was the first museum survey of the movement anywhere in the world. The show included nearly 700 objects and traveled to other cities, Chicago, San Francisco, etc. And it generated a lot of attention. It was clear by then that surrealism had caught the American imagination, even though it was far from being embraced by everyone, and actually more articles were making fun of it than praising it. It became what represented modern art in America. Whether or not it was taken seriously as an artistic movement, it generated a response both in the artistic community and from the public at large. So having set the stage with these preliminaries, I would like now to propose to assess the specificity of American surrealism by identifying four main differences between American and European surrealism. So these will be the four parts of the rest of my talk. First, American surrealism in the 20s and 30s was restricted to a figurative style. And that's why it was important to show all the range of style that it represented in Europe, because that just doesn't apply, at least not until later. And I should have said that I'm focusing more on the 20s and 30s in this talk, because the situation changes really radically with the Second World War. At that time, American artists showed basically no interest in automatism and other chance methods until the 1940s. So here are two early examples of works that show a surrealist tendency in American art. Peter Blume, Parade from 1930, and Francis Crist, a painting that is in the exhibition. Both derive their surrealist aspect from the unexpected foreground figures that give a certain strangeness to the pictures. On one side, it's the man parading an armor, and on the other, two solitary nuns in a deserted street. Such paintings show that the first manifestations of surrealism in America were in fact indebted to an artist who was not actually a surrealist, and that's the Italian Giorgio de Chirico. And here are just two examples to remind you of his style. As you see, those paintings are from 1914. De Chirico had been a very important model for the French surrealist who admired his works. They collected them, and they included them in their exhibition. They called him the father of surrealism. But the paintings by de Chirico that they admired, such as these two, were done in the teens, between roughly 1911 and 1917. That is, before there was any surrealist movement. De Quirico was not known in the United States until the late 20s, when his first one-man show in New York took place at the Valentine Gallery in 1928, followed then by another one in 29. So that's about at the same time as artists were learning about surrealism, and they just put everything together. So De Quirico was a critical success, and until the Americans discovered Dalí's work a few years later, De Quirico was surrealism for them. De Quirico's works depict empty urban spaces with strange perspectives, tilted grounds, long shadows that create mysterious atmosphere. They often include juxtaposition, incongruous juxtapositions of familiar objects such as bananas, artichoke, and instead of figures, they often have mannequins, as you can see here. In addition, the poetic titles that De Quirico gave his paintings emphasized the feeling of mystery, as they often included words such as enigma, mystery, melancholy. So De Quirico's art appealed particularly to American modernists who were associated with the precisionist movement, which was the dominant avant-garde movement in the 1920s. And here, just as a reminder, are two precisionist paintings in the exhibition. They often showed empty urban views with a sense of stillness, silence, immobility, similar to De Quirico's paintings. So it was a subtle step from the deserted urban vistas of the precisionist to the enigmatic streets and squares of De Quirico. It took, in fact, very little, as you can see here, it took very little, an odd figure or a dramatic shadow, to add mystery and create a slight tension and bring an ominous feeling to the picture. So both paintings, the Bloom... I think I want to go back here. These are the paintings I'm talking about. Both paintings show the crisp lines and clear geometry of precisionism. And that the fact that the two black silhouettes of the nuns in the foreground of Chris's painting appeared somewhat incongruous was confirmed by reviewers' comments when this painting was included in the first biennial exhibition of contemporary American painting at the Whitney Museum in 1932. One of them noted that this painting was among the evidence of the surrealist invasion. Of course, we are now later in 1932. The Lévy show was in early 32, and so immediately you see the impact on the paintings that were produced that year. And now Peter Blume was included in that same biennial with this painting, which showed similar technical precision, and note in particular the rendering of the church and the architectural elements in the center, but in a scene that has become even stranger in its evocation of modern technology as a form of religion. Note that the title is The Light of the World, which refers to the biblical phrase. Now, in addition to De Quirico, there was another European artist who, though little known today, was quite famous at the time and made a mark in the early years of American surrealism, and that's the French painter Pierre Roy. Roy was a friend of De Quirico who had introduced him to Breton and to the other French surrealists. His work was included in the first surrealist exhibition in Paris, 1925. Now, this painting, Electrification of the Country, was in fact the first surrealist painting to enter an American museum. When it was bought by Jake Austin at the Wadsworth Athenaeum in 1931 for the amount of $2,100, which was actually quite a sum, which shows that Roy had a certain reputation in America at the time. He had had a large one-man exhibition at the Brummer Gallery in New York in 1930 that was very well received. Now, what the Americans praised overall in the art of Pierre Roy was the extreme quality of the execution of his paintings, his highly precise rendering of each object, and here are two other paintings by him. This technical proficiency and craft were very important in America. One could forgive the oddity of the imagery if it was so well painted. In reviews of surrealist exhibitions, Roy's craftsmanship saved him from the harsh criticism that other artists received, such as Miro or Ernst, for instance. In fact, Roy's technique linked him to the trompe l'œil tradition, which had been important in American painting, and the trompe l'œil is still life. And just as a reminder, here are some examples from late 19th century by two of the main representatives of American still life painting, Pitot and Harnett. And the emphasis on craftsmanship in the history of American art explains the attraction for an artist like Pierre Roy. Americans had a particular admiration for his painstaking rendering of reality, an admiration that goes back to go even further than the trompe l'œil to John Singleton Copley in the 18th century. Note the crisp quality of the rendering, in which one can see a precursor to precisionism. And it's a quality, a particularly American quality, which Copley lost when he went to Europe, where it was not appreciated in the same way. So this continues to the 20th century. Now, this admiration for technique is the reason, one of the reasons, but maybe the main reason, Dalí would become the representative of surrealism in the United States in the 1930s. His superb technique was admired by all the critics, even if they questioned or frankly disliked the subject matter of his paintings. Many felt actually that he was wasting his talent on such strange and downright objectionable imagery. So Dalí was the sensation of the first exhibitions of surrealism in the U.S., This painting, The Persistence of Memory, was, may still be actually, the most famous surrealist painting. It was shown at Julian Levy in New York in 1932, and it entered the collection of the Museum of Modern Art a few years later. Julian Levy had bought it for $250 from the artist, an interesting comparison with the painting by Roy that I mentioned earlier, given the respective reputation of the artists today. This painting was the one that was most caricatured in the press, and then limp and soft objects became a hallmark of surrealism, as you can see in... Oh, I brought another Dalí just to show another example of the very precise technique. Here is, for instance, one of those works evidently influenced by Dalí, with object becoming soft. You will notice also a mix of a little bit of De Chirico still there with the mannequins. Again, we have some nuns. I mean, the reason those nuns are associated with surrealism, I think, come from the films in The Andalusian Dog. And, you have the films by Buñuel and Dalí. This anti-clerical sentiment was expressed with odd scenes with nuns, which may explain why they appear as a feature of surrealist art. And another example of the soft shapes in this Guglielmi painting, Mental Geography, a work that was inspired by the Spanish Civil War, and to which I will come back in another section. So in the second half of the 1930s, American surrealism was completely dominated by the influence of Dalí. And the most important follower of Dalí in America, in a more serious way perhaps than the Marengo that we saw earlier, is Federico Castellon, with this maybe his best painting, which is in the exhibition. And as you can see, Castellon goes beyond just superficial imitation of some of the features of Dalí and really creates a painting that has a certain psychological depth with this shrouded figure that evoked the mystery of the unconscious and the intertwined figures in the background. Now, the second difference between, this is my second point, second difference between surrealism in the U.S. and in France is that in the United States it was not an organized movement the way it was in France. In Paris, the surrealists formed a group around a leader, André Breton. They held regular meetings. They were meeting at the same café at the same time every day. They even had apparently the same drinks, which changed according to the season. And they published manifestos. They published a magazine. Here's the cover of the first one, the first issue of La Révolution Surrealiste, Surrealist Revolution. They organized demonstrations, they took official positions on issues, etc. There were quarrels and disagreements among the members, many of whom resented Breton's authority. They called him the Pope. There were expulsions and resignations, there were dissidents, but all of this precisely reinforced the notion that such a group existed. By contrast, in the United States, surrealism corresponded to a more individual attitude. Artists such as Peter Bloom, Joseph Cornell, or Federico Castellon worked independently. There were no manifesto, no agenda, and at least until the Europeans began arriving in the late 1930s, there were no surrealist magazines published by the artists. The few publications on surrealism in the US in the 30s were the catalogs that were published either by dealers or by such as Julian Levy, or by the museum directors, such as Chick Austin and Alfred Barr. So artists in America, artists knew each other and exhibited together, notably at Julian Levy Gallery and later on at Peggy Guggenheim's, but they did not organize themselves into a group. In the 1940s, when the French surrealists came in exile in the US, Breton attempted to reorganize the group that had been disbanded by the war, but it didn't really work out. For one thing, there were no cafes in New York where they could all meet. They were living too far apart. Some were downtown, some were uptown, and several of them who didn't like the city had chosen to live in the country, especially in Connecticut, where, for instance, Masson and Gorky were. Now, one exception to this idea of no group is a group of California artists, and I mention it because actually there is one work in the exhibition by one of these artists, a group that called themselves the Post-Surrealists, who did publish a manifesto in 1934, and who exhibited together for about 6 years, and they were led by Lorsor Feilson and Helen Lundeberg, who was actually a couple. One could say that they formed the only organized surrealist group in the U.S., but although they introduced surrealist devices in their works, such as odd juxtapositions and contrasts of scale, their position differed from that of the Europeans in that they had a much more specific artistic program. And remember that Breton's manifesto did not impose any particular style or any particular form of art, but more a general attitude toward creativity and even toward life in general. The post-surrealist program was a form of symbolism. Their paintings may look strange, but could in fact be decoded in a very specific way. They often involved relationships between macrocosm and microcosm, as in these works. And such a specific system of interpretation was in contrast with the position of Breton and the French surrealists, who always favored multiple possible interpretations. To the Europeans, it was important not to impose a particular reading, but instead to open the imagination. Breton didn't like symbol, but comparisons, especially the type of unexpected comparisons that created a surprise, that created some kind of disorientation. By contrast, here in the Feilson painting, you see a very logical link between the different elements around the idea of genesis or birth, you know, from the egg and the avocado pit, the navel, and then going into the planets in the seen through the window. And likewise, the Lundeberg lithograph brings together a still life with different balls and the image of a planet on the books on the floor, in a sort of conflation of near and far that evokes Magritte, who was an artist that the post-surrealists admired. Now, in France, the idea of a group was connected to the political engagement of the artists. The surrealist group was active politically from the beginning, and especially in the late 20s and 30s, surrealism had a political dimension. The organ of the movement, as I showed you earlier, was called La Révolution Surrealiste, which did not refer only to an aesthetic or artistic revolution, but also political and social. On this cover of the first issue of La Révolution Surrealiste is the sentence, you may not be able to read because I'm not sure it's sharp enough, and anyway, it's in French, but it means we must aim toward a new declaration of the rights of man. So the artistic revolution, or I'm sorry, the revolution that the surrealists called for was to be part of a more general program of liberation from nationalism, from militarism, capitalism, etc. The surrealists in France tried to ally themselves with the Communist Party, who shared similar revolutionary ideals. But the alliance actually never really worked because the cultural policy of the Communist Party never matched the Surrealist ideas. The political position of the Surrealists explain why the United States do not appear on the Surrealist map of the world published in 1929. There is basically nothing between Mexico and Alaska, which, as you know, was not part of the United States at the time. So the political dimensions of the movement just did not exist in the United States. There was no equivalent to a leader like Breton. Surrealism, which had been promoted by museum directors and dealers, and they had no interest in promoting a left-wing agenda. They were dependent on wealthy people to support their program and to buy the paintings. And also Alfred Barr at the Modern felt that the museum should preserve political neutrality. As a result, all of them toned down or ignored completely the political aspect. Julian Levy later acknowledged that when he said, recalling the 30s, he said, if Breton had been there at that time, there would no doubt have been a more orthodox representation. But he said that what he presented was surrealism in the language of the New World. None of the texts by Breton and the other French surrealists were translated into English until 1936. Therefore, most artists and critics were not aware of the political goals of the original movement. Now, there were a few American artists who saw in surrealism a potential to address the social issues of the day. Although these artists did not form a coherent group, they have been lumped together later under the name social surrealists. They include notably Louis Guglielmi, and there is one painting that's in the exhibition, and the other one which I showed earlier. Two other lesser-known artists called social surrealists are James Guy and Walter Quirt. All were associated with the social realist tendency, but they felt that they could give more intensity to their social and political comments by using some of the surrealist features. They did not embrace surrealism ideas, but they applied surrealist techniques, primarily indented to Dali, to their social and political subjects. A 1938 article entitled Proletarian Surrealism in one of those leftist publications, either Art France or the New Masses, don't remember, summarized their attitude. A style of painting usually identified with extreme individualism and decadence takes on a new vigor and meaning when it is used to express the moods and emotions of the dispossessed. Americans were not interested in depictions of personal phantasms, but in the evocation of subjects and images that concerned everyone and that everyone could decipher. The problem, however, was that their paintings were perceived as being too difficult to understand, therefore not good as a propaganda tool and not good to convey a message. As one of the leftist reviewers wrote in 1936, surrealism is a false medium for the revolutionary artist. It uses an occult language which needlessly separates the artist from his audience. And we could say, actually, that Guglielmi, The Various Spring, is a little bit of a case in point because it's quite an enigmatic painting. It has been interpreted in different ways, and particularly in connection with Guernica and bombing, the kites being seen as the bombs, and there are actually little bombs you probably can't see, but in... and maybe this is all explained on the label in the exhibition, but... Oh, sorry. On each of these, you have a little bomb. And then there is a child who appears to be dead. There is a year, the number 29, which may refer to the year of the crash, etc. So there are mysterious symbols. So it may be about the effect of war on civilian life, but it abounds in symbols that are not very obvious. The painting on the right, Mental Geography, is somewhat clearer thanks to a text by the artist explaining that this was a vision of the Brooklyn Bridge after an air raid, and also in reference to the bombing during the Spanish Civil War. I brought just two more examples of those works related to social surrealism, the Peter Blum Eternal City, which is a vision of fascist Rome with Mussolini as a jack-in-the-box. And on the right, James Guy, Venus on 6th Avenue. 6th Avenue referring probably to Macy's. And as you see, the Macy's sales girl is being sort of crushed by the hand of the businessman who is trying to prevent her from looking at women workers who are on strike and encourage her to admire the sort of traditional image of the woman put on a pedestal but with no voice. You know, she can't talk and she can't look where she wants. But social surrealism remained a very limited tendency in 1930s America. And what essentially undermined the revolutionary nature of surrealism in this country was that from the start, it was associated with entertainment. And this is... Oh, not yet. Hold on. But this is my third point. Surrealism perceived as entertainment. In his presentation of the first exhibition of surrealism in America in 1931 at the Wordsworth Athenaeum, which I mentioned earlier, Chick Austin downplayed the seriousness of the paintings, emphasizing instead their light side, comparing them to fashion and the movie. He told the local newspaper, "These pictures which you are going to see are chic, they are entertaining, they are of the moment. We do not have to take them too seriously to enjoy them." And Austin compared the excitement that they produced, the surprise created by the strangeness, to the effect produced by a movie thriller. And this position may have been a strategy to disarm the critics rather than reflecting what Chick Austin really thought. But the same strategy was used by Julian Levy, who claimed that the first examples of surrealism in the U.S. were the tabloids, of which he included a few examples in his 1932 exhibition. And of course, the years 1931-32 were the worst years of the Depression, and it may have seemed a good strategy to present the oddity of surrealism as a diversion from the harsh realities of the time rather than something to which one should pay serious attention to. But even Alfred Barr, in the 1936 exhibition at the Modern, though he defended the seriousness of the movement in his catalog introduction, he associated it with lighter forms by including in the exhibition Walt Disney and Ruby Goldberg. And these are actually the two works that were in the 1936 Surrealist exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. So that was undermining a little bit this sort of seriousness that he was claiming for the movement. In fact, it is as if those who were promoting the movement were worried that the American public would be shocked by the strangeness of surrealism, so they tamed it, as it were, by presenting it as a form of entertainment rather than serious art, presumably with the assumption that people would be less offended and would accept it more readily. The critics, who did not, at least those who did not completely reject the movement, tended to adopt the same stance. Edward Alden Jewell, who was a critic of the New York Times, wrote about the 1932 exhibition at Julian Levy that it was, quote, "one of the most entertaining exhibitions of the season, an hour of the most captivating diversion." And again in 1936, he wrote about the exhibition at the Modern that it was an opulent circus, the most incredibly mad divertissement the town has ever seen, a charming interlude of irrationality. And in the same vein, another critic wrote that looking at surrealist pictures was like taking a trip to Mars or visiting the zoo to look at the strange beasts. So now this aspect of the perception of surrealism in the U.S. was well understood by one artist, that is Salvador Dali, who said, "What with us had tragic undertones assumed at most an aspect of entertainment in America." Dali was quick to see the potential of this vision of the movement for his own publicity. He understood well, for instance, the connection with the movies, a highly popular form of entertainment in the 1930s. Dali himself, as I mentioned earlier, had made movies with Buñuel, and he was attuned to the possibilities of the possibilities that the movies offered to combine dream and reality in such a way that it was hard to distinguish them. Dali's relationship with Hollywood has led one art historian to note that when Americans mention surrealism's attachment to Marx, they were not referring to Karl Marx, but to the Marx brothers. And indeed, in 1937, Dali sent a card to André Breton from California in which he wrote, "I am in Hollywood, where I have made contact with the three American surrealists, Harpo Marx, Disney, and Cecil B. DeMille." Dali was particularly taken by the absurd humor of the Marx brothers. He even worked on a screenplay for them called Giraffes on Horseback Salad, which was never filmed. He also created a surreal harp with strings of barbed wire for Harpo Marx, who, as you see, responded by showing up with bandaged fingers. In the 1940s, Dali would also work with Hitchcock on the dream sequence of Spellbound. So the arrival of surrealism during the worst years of the Depression was, in fact, a bad timing. The mad subjects of the paintings seemed to be completely irrelevant to the realities of the time. Moreover, it was a period of isolation. The dominant movements were regionalism and American scene painting. Coming from Europe, surrealism was rejected as being foreign and decadent. Surrealism could find a place into the American cultural landscape only if it was treated as a form of entertainment. Transformed into a spectacle, surrealism lost its subversive aspect. To the Americans, surrealism did not offer a different way to deal with the real world, as it did in Europe, but it offered, rather, a way to escape from it. And finally, my last point of comparison between European and American surrealism is that the Americans toned down, if not ignored entirely, the erotic dimension of the original surrealist movement. Love, sex, and erotic desire were major themes of European surrealism, which was influenced by Freud, for whom sexual instincts and their sublimation were central to the development of the individual. A large part of surrealist literature is devoted to the theme of love. One of André Breton's main books is Mad Love. In the visual arts, I could have chosen many, many examples. This is just a sample. Miro's paintings abound in sexual symbols. Max Ernst did many erotic collages. Most of Dali's paintings have to do with sexuality, etc. So here are just a few examples to illustrate this point. But this was an aspect that did not appeal to American artists, who tended to shy away from such explicit and even less explicit imagery. When Julian Levy organized his exhibition in 1932, he expressed concerns about Dali's sexual subjects. His assistant wrote at the time, "Julian is not quite sure how much Dali he dares show in the gallery at once." Such concerns reflect American sexual attitudes at the time. It was clearly a more repressive society than Europe. Of course, Hollywood had its sex symbols, Mae West, for instance, but in painting, it seems that the rules were a little different. And as an example, when Thomas Hart Benton, of course, he's not a surrealist by any means, but this is just to illustrate this American attitude. When Benton painted this vision of Hollywood, symbolized by a, note, semi-nude woman, in 1937, Life magazine, which had commissioned the image as part of a series on Hollywood, refused to reproduce it in its pages. It's pretty tame, as you would see, but Benton's painting, in fact, was an homage to Jean Harlow, one of those sex symbols, who had died earlier that year and who was from Kansas City, where Benton was living at the time. But I would like to show some more subtle comparisons to illustrate the different approaches towards sexual imagery in European and American surrealism. On the left is Alexander Haug, Mother Earth Laid Bare, Erosion No. 2, a painting from 1936 from the Philbrook Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma. On the right, Pavel Chelichev, Fata Morgana. Alexander Haug, who could have been in the exhibition here if the Whitney had a painting by him. Haug belongs to a group of artists that were active in Texas in the 1930s and often referred to as the Dallas Nine. They were regionalist in their subjects, but somewhat less conventional in their style because they incorporated aspects of modernism and notably a sense of unreality that related them to surrealism, especially in the work of Haug. This painting is part of a series of works in which Haug depicted the ravages of the Dust Bowl, denouncing the misuse of the land that created the erosion and the destruction of the farmland. In a rather striking double image, here the land is represented by a bare woman. The prominent plow in the foreground refers to the overplowing, and also some have said it's a suggestion of rape, in fact. So the overplowing that washed away the topsoil and exposed the bare earth. So while Mother Earth is traditionally associated with fertility, here she appears desolate. Chelichev, on the other hand, an artist who came to America from Europe and who was trained in Europe, used a similar device of the double image, conflating a body with the landscape, but he created a much more erotic image in this vision of two lovers lying next to each other, plus which here the green palette suggests images of fertility. So both artists use the same stylistic device in these metaphoric representations of the earth as a human body in order to give more poignancy to their subject, But when one is more erotic, the other exploited the imagery with a more pragmatic purpose to make a statement against agricultural practice. It should be noted, however, that Hogg did not embrace the term surrealism. He even took great pain to disassociate himself from the European movement. He described his aesthetic conception as psychoreality, insisting that it didn't have anything to do with the unconscious and a dream world, but rather that he, quote, used visual psychology to present realities of the mind in an orderly, not disorderly fashion. Remember, surrealism was associated with foreign art, and for the regionalists, that was no-no. Discussing his work in an application for a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1938, Hogg rejected the term surrealism, which had been used by critics discussing his work, claiming that his paintings came out of a wholly American experience. Now, Hogg's image actually relates to a painting of the same date in the exhibition and of the same subject by the regionalist Joe Jones, which I bring here so you have a comparison. Jones shows here a vision of farmland ravaged by the drought and the erosion. And also, to give it more context, here is another painting by Hogg from the same series showing similar subjects and treatment with a tilted perspective, disproportioned, and a prominent vulture, all of this creating an ominous feeling in what could be described as a rural equivalent of the de Chirico-esque paintings of the city. Now, another comparison illustrates what one could call this desexualization of surrealism on this side of the Atlantic. On the left is Otis Doger, grasshopper and farmer. The painting is unlocated, which is why it's only a black and white illustrations. He also made a print of it, a lithograph, which is, I put in small under. And on the right, of course, Dali, the great masturbator of 1929, in which you see the grasshopper here. Now, Doger belongs to the same group of Texas regionalists as Hogg, and he achieved here a surreal effect in the disproportion between the grasshopper and the man, using this difference in scale to emphasize the plight of the farmer. The outsized grasshopper symbolizes the forces of nature that triumph over man, here represented by the helpless farmer. By contrast, the grasshopper that appears frequently in Dali's paintings, this is only one example, but there are many paintings with grasshoppers, they represent a much more personal form of symbolism. The grasshopper is an obsessive image from his childhood that Dali associated with fear and horror. The painting evokes the sexual tensions and anxieties that were tormenting Dali and that are the subject of many of his works. So this last comparison is a good example of a fundamental difference between European and American surrealism, which is that the Americans rejected the very personal dimension of European surrealism, the idea that you express in art your own fears and desires, and especially of a sexual nature. For the Americans, this was a form of exhibitionism, which they rejected. American artists who used surrealist techniques did not do so to express their own problems, but to give a greater emphasis to their subjects, which were inspired by contemporary life in America. A New York critic reviewing the works by several Texas artists at the New York World Fair of 1939 expressed it clearly. He wrote, Emily Gennauer, they resort to the surrealist idiom not to depict their irrational dreams, but to dramatize the narrative. So in conclusion, I better go back. We can turn it off. In conclusion, although surrealism became progressively better known in the U.S. throughout the 1930s, it was never fully embraced by American artists who only retained from it a few stylistic features. One can perhaps attribute to an ingrained sense of reality and pragmatism this reluctance to embrace the irrational and the extraordinary that define European surrealism. A major change then occurred in the early 1940s when a number of young American artists turned to automatism and the more abstract forms of surrealism. Miro and Masson became the important models for artists such as Archil Gorky and Jackson Pollock. abstraction took over and became the predominant mode. The figurative tendency, however, continued to have its adepts, as one can see in the paintings from the 40s and 50s in the exhibition, for instance, by Gerard French, George Tucker, and John Wilder. And it is a wonderful aspect of the exhibition, Real Surreal, that the originality and the contribution of such artists are finally reconsidered and given their due in the history of American art. Thank you. We can take...